Welcome to the Clubhouse with Shane Bacon. I'm your host, Shane Bacon. This week's episode with Jaime Diaz is brought to you by Ogio. If you're in need of a new golf bag, you should give the Ogio Stinger golf bag a look. It's a beautiful bag meant to make walking a little simpler for you, with a convenient water bottle sleeve, the impressive wood top to keep all your clubs separated, and all the pockets you'll need to have your bag packed with balls, snacks, tees, and much more. The Stinger bag by Ogio is a great option for any and all skill-level golfers. Check out ogio.com for their entire line and more right now. And frankly, a bit of a surprise this past weekend at the Players' Championship. I don't really think any of us had that leaderboard, that roster of top five names on our list. But nonetheless, exciting. Siwoo Kim played out of his mind, 21 years old, looked like a veteran, looked like he'd won plenty of times on tour, didn't really let that final three-hole stretch bother him in the least. It was interesting. We get to 17, and I really think all day we were waiting to see somebody crash and burn on this par three, especially with the names we were looking at that might win this thing. I was kind of expecting to see maybe an Ian Poulter disaster, maybe see Siwoo Kim threw in the water, make it exciting, and they just didn't. They played it smart. You know, really the only one we saw was J.B. Holmes after his day had basically been done in already by just the psycho of scorecards that you'll ever see. If you haven't seen that yet, you can see it on our Clubhouse newsletter. We send out a psycho scorecard every Monday, try to find one that was really all over the place. And J.B. Holmes, we might have to name it after him after that. I mean, he made four birdies and still shoots in the 80s. It was crazy. But, you know, we really didn't see any fireworks one way or the other. It was just a business-like final round for Siwoo Kim, and he wins the Players' Championship and adds his name to a growing list of the biggest in the game to win there. So congrats to him. I mean, it might not have been, again, the leaderboard that we kind of had hoped to see, but in golf, you've got to take it for what it is, and we take it with, you know, knowledge that we have another 21-year-old that has all the talent that you'd want to see from someone and, you know, will contend in big tournaments occasionally and might win a major. I mean, this is the generation that it is. But had a great conversation with Jaime Diaz of Golf World and Golf Digest. You read his stuff all the time. One of the best scribes out there, does an incredible job painting the picture of the PGA Tour week in and week out. And we had a lengthy conversation, so I want to get to that. So enough for me. Let's jump into the conversation with Jaime. And we welcome into the Clubhouse the editor-in-chief of Golf World, senior writer for Golf Digest. You love his articles as much as I do, I'm sure, Jaime Diaz. Jaime, I appreciate you taking some time. I wanted to start with one thing, though, and I have a little complaint. On March 2nd, you tweeted out that you were caving, you were coming back to Twitter. Since then, five tweets. So basically, is the comeback, has it kind of like halted a little?
Yeah, I have to confess I've gotten a little gun-shy. I really feel so old when I talk about this because I read Twitter all the time and I value Twitter. And our president, for better or worse, lives off of Twitter. And I just have a hard time pulling the trigger. I'm not sure why. I can be a wiseacre in an email to some individual person I know, but I have a little fear of, even though I publish all the time, and in that voice, I'm sort of still hesitant to kind of let go. I feel like I might do the wrong thing, do something untoward that will get me in trouble, but more than anything, I'm just a little uncomfortable. I'm not sure of the voice. I know there's a promotional aspect to it, and you know, obviously your employers like you to tweet, and so I should be doing it, and I'm glad you're kind of calling me out publicly and humiliating me like this, so I'll do it more. And if I don't do it and I'm on again, boy,
I'm gonna hammer you if when we do this in a few months and there's still only five. Well, you know, the first thing, of course, I wanted to talk to you about is a Players' Championship that wrapped up. I would say not what we were expecting. I mean, I think, you know, with the way Dustin has played lately and, you know, all the names that we kind of had expected to see contend at an event that usually has this star-studded type of leaderboard, it was a different feel. I mean, can you think and remember a Players' Championship that comes Sunday had this, and I don't want to say watered down of a leaderboard, but this lack of names on a leaderboard, really with a real legit chance to win?
You know, it happens so often, Shane, in golf, and you know what? It happens a lot hasn't recently maybe as much. It's certainly in the Tiger era, but it's happened a lot in major championships. And it tends to happen, in my opinion, when the golf courses are really hard, when it's firm and fast and nobody's hitting a lot of greens and there aren't that many birdie opportunities. You see grinders come to the fore. And some great players have been grinders. I mean, nobody could grind like Tiger, and Jack Nicklaus was a heck of a grinder. But in general, it kind of has an equalizing effect for the guys who, you know, are kind of the tough journeymen in terms of their comparison with, you know, the more spectacular, physically gifted, we call them bombers now. Those are the guys, obviously, that are fan favorites, and we want to see win, or I say we, you know, collectively. There's more excitement when Dustin is in full flight. But the conditions at the Players this year especially, I think in May, you know, when it starts getting firm and fast and a little windy, it's a really delicate golf course. And, you know, I mean, Siwoo Kim only hit 8 greens yesterday, even though he looked like he was playing pretty darn good. So, you know, that was the kind of the challenge yesterday, was to keep saving par, as opposed to, even though those par fives are reachable, they're very hard to hit in two and keep it on the green. You know, there just weren't a lot of, it wasn't a volatile leaderboard. It's not like the back nine at Augusta. So, you know, I'm giving you a roundabout answer, but I have seen, you know, I've seen Tim Clark win there. And I mean, Dean Beaman, you know, it's partly his creation. I mean, Pete Dye, I think it's his masterpiece, but Dean had a big influence, and Dean was a grinder. And I think the DNA of, you know, TPC Sawgrass is basically a point-to-point golf course where you know where you're, you got to know where you're missing it, and you have to be defensive, and it's very hard to take on a lot of pins. And, you know, the guys who win, I would say over the years, and even Tiger when he won, and Tiger had a hard time at that golf course. I mean, I know he won in 2013, and he'd only won one other time in 2001, and in general, he had probably a higher average finish there than anywhere else. The power players tend to suffer.
Yeah, you know, it reminded me, and I haven't said this yet, but I kept thinking of this yesterday as I was watching Siwoo Kim. I mean, you mentioned the 8 greens. It really had this Retief Goose in its Southern Hills feel to it on Sunday. You know,
or Shinnecock even more.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, Goosen was an unknown name. I mean, he was a talented guy, but really his first, I would say his first venture into the world stage back at Southern Hills, and he was missing these fairways. He was hitting all these bunkers, and he was just grinding out that round. He shoots the final round 71, of course, you know, famously 3 putts on the final green, but it felt a little like that. I mean, I kept thinking, you know, if he keeps missing greens, he's going to make a bogey, and he just didn't. I mean, it was really impressive. And again, this is a 21-year-old kid. I mean, he's not Jordan Spieth-like. He's not, you know, I mean, he's not Matthew Fitzpatrick. I mean, it's not that level of these guys we've watched since they were 14, 15, 16. But in a sense, this is another name added to this list of young 20-somethings that have major championship pedigree.
I think it's easy to underestimate this young guy because we just don't know that much about him. And let's face it, being Korean, you know, I think sometimes American fans just don't connect. It certainly we've seen that on the LPGA Tour where there's domination by the South Koreans. But, you know, I would say this kid has got some pretty amazing pedigree to make the PGA Tour at 17 and to win last year at 20. I mean, I know we've made a big deal out of a lot of young guys who, you know, they're impressive and they're all Americans and we know them well through their junior careers. But, you know, just watching this young guy, I didn't see many holes. Now, the irony is he's played horrible the last 5-6 months.
Right.
But, you know, I just talked to Sean Foley, and, you know, the fix is, if it's the right fix for a tour player, it clicks in pretty fast sometimes. Now, he's been working on this for about 3 months. He got into some pretty bad habits with the driver and was just hitting these huge blocks. And as you probably know, he was last in strokes gained off the tee. He had gotten short and crooked. But in any event, he fixed it. And I just think, you know, there's real ability in that young guy. You're right. He doesn't have the college career. We don't know a lot about him. But I think to make the tour at age 17, that says a lot. You know, there's some DNA there, to use that phrase again, that you see in the prodigies. You know, you see Sergio and Tiger.
Yeah, and you mentioned his driving struggles earlier in the year. I feel like Sawgrass is a type of place that almost helps guys that hit it a little crooked. I mean, if you hit it really crooked, you can make huge numbers. I mean, we saw that with J.B. Holmes yesterday. But, you know, if you hit it crooked and you're used to playing out of the rough, it almost feels a little bit like a U.S. Open where, you know, Siwoo Kim is a guy that's been doing that all year. I mean, he's going to miss fairways, as is everybody else in the field, because it's such a tight, tight ballpark. I almost feel like it might help a guy like him knowing, you know, I've got these shots. I've been playing them like that all year long.
Well, to some extent, I didn't find him to be a scrambler. I mean, I thought he drove it pretty well. The ball was not staying on the green real well. But he was, you know, he was missing in good places, you know, and he's got a very nice short game. I mean, you saw that up and down on 14. You know, you mentioned Goosen, and it really did remind me of Shinnecock even more than Southern Hills. I know the Southern Hills part, he had not been, you know, sort of exposed to the public, and by the time he was winning at Shinnecock, he was a star. But Shinnecock was a golf course that was so firm and fast and was not that long, because it was a classic golden era course, and they probably needed more length even if it hadn't been firm and fast. But it was really hard to keep the ball in the green. And Goosen just, it was incredible how he putted, because nobody could make a putt on those greens. And you remember they closed the seventh green because it was so firm and the ball was running off. So, you know, I don't know about Kim's, I thought he used kind of a similar formula, short game and putting and good management. And, you know, again, you say he's 21, does he have that much maturity? Well, you know, it's funny, some guys are savants. I think he played with a very heady style of play. He, to me, yesterday, he looked by far the best player.
Yeah, for sure.
On that day. Yep. You know, and that doesn't mean he's the best player, but, you know, on that day, I was really impressed. And, you know, it's every pro when they're on is awesome, but to do it in the heat and the pressure of the Sunday of the players, that's an extra dimension. So I think the guy's going to be heard from.
You mentioned Sean Foley, and I was going to ask you this later, but I'll ask it now. How big was this win for Sean Foley, really, in the sense when you look at his resume? Because, you know, I mean, when you think, when you ask an average golf fan Sean Foley, they think of that whole Tiger experiment with him. How big was this win seeing, you know, a very, very young student of his go out there after struggling with his golf swing, finding it and winning in one of the biggest stages of the year?
Well, it's big. You know, it's big for sort of the unwashed golf fan. And I kind of include myself in a way, because I don't pretend to know as much as these players and these instructors. And sometimes we judge them too much on their most successful player. But sometimes they do incredible work just to get a guy on the tour or you keep him out there. And, you know, coaching Tiger is a double-edged sword, because, you know, people are going to say, hey, he's Tiger Woods. He doesn't even need a coach.
Right.
I mean, all you can do is screw it up. And to some extent, that was the perception of Sean. You know, oh, he's too scientific. He got Tiger out of his natural swing. Now Tiger with Chris Como, even though Chris Como is very much biomechanically kind of oriented teacher also, like Sean, you know, he's going back to his natural junior swing. So he was kind of the culprit. But even Hank Haney, to some extent, was the culprit with Tiger. As great as Tiger did under Hank, it still wasn't, a lot of people's perception, this perfect golf that Tiger, you know, allegedly played. And I'm not knocking the golf. It was incredible. It might be romanticized a bit because Tiger was an incredible putter in 2000 as well. But, you know, what he achieved with Butch in 2000 and 2001, the Tiger Slam and all that, no one's ever, at least as the instructor, been given that same achievement that Butch accomplished. So, but with Sean, you know, he redeemed himself somewhat with Justin Rose. Justin Rose winning the Open at Marion under Sean. That was big for Sean. And Justin has one of the best-looking swings, most admired swings by his peers. So that's partly, you know, built by Sean Foley. So, yeah, he took a hit with Tiger, I guess, and then regained a lot of stature with Justin. But it's never enough, right? I mean, the public perception is always being judged and is always judging. You know, Justin Rose, although he almost won the Masters, you know, has only got that one major. And I think this in a way, is sort of a mini reclamation project with Kim. And I think it helps Sean a lot. And, you know, obviously Sean had, you know, he's had some other players, Hunter Mahan has kind of lost his game, you know, probably for lifestyle reasons. I mean, just getting married and having kids. And Sean O'Hare left Sean Foley. So, Ledbetter's taken a million hits.
Right.
And, you know, he's been blamed for Michelle Wee. I think they get too much credit and get too much blame.
Right. I totally agree. Well, on that same thought, a lot was made kind of out of nowhere was the way Ian Poulter finished his Players' Championship. Randall Chamblee kind of going all in on Poulter, basically saying he was playing for second place. He wasn't playing to win. I mean, Poulter didn't even have his card a few weeks back, and then, you know, they went through this whole thing. Brian Gay found a loophole, got him back into the tour. Now he wins $924,000 with his second place finish at the Players Championship. Does this type of thing happen more than we want to talk about when players are out there knowing, you know, I might not be able to catch this guy leading, but I don't want to drop a shot because I know how important every single place is, not just for money, but for FedEx Cup points and what it'll do for world ranking?
Well, I'm sure, you know, it's a calculation. It's a profession. And I would say, coming from where Ian Poulter is coming from right now, this moment, first of all, I'm not sure that Brandel knows exactly what he was thinking. That's kind of presumptuous. You know, he may have not felt comfortable with his golf swing, regardless of what position he was in. And the other thing I'd say is, that's the kind of golf course where you let somebody else lose as opposed to try to win.
For sure.
Not every time. I mean, we saw Ricky make a ton of birdies coming in. But in general, you know, you don't want to shoot yourself out of it. The guy behind you might make a 7 on 17. So, you know, I think there was that calculation. But my sense was, especially watching the second shot on 18, you know, he was probably starting to feel a lot of stress and not feeling that confident. I mean, Ian Poulter is not a great ball striker. He's a gutsy player. And, man, I mean, he really sacked up yesterday because that was really, you know, he was on the line. But, you know, he looked like he was running out of gas. I mean, the shot on 17, I know he didn't go for it on 16. He's not a high ball hitter. Maybe he felt like this could bounce into the water. I tend to give those guys the benefit of the doubt. So, but to your point, do guys play for money sometimes? Yes, obviously. And that's a lot of money. And he's thinking about his career and solidifying in it. You know, it's not a major. Not to say you don't want to win the Players, but I think, you know, the real history is made with one of the four majors, and maybe Poulter would have been a little bolder, possibly. I really think it's every time, and you play enough golf, sometimes you feel good about it, and sometimes you feel terrible about the shot you're about to hit. And even those guys, and they've told, you know, as you know, you talk to them too, they sometimes really are steering it around, and just, as Jack Nicklaus said, you know, playing badly well. And, you know, to try to force something just because that's what the crowd wants. I mean, Chip Bet took so much heat for laying up back at the Masters, but he had every good reason not to go for it on 15 there. And that was similar. He was trailing, I think, longer by 2 or 3. You know, and didn't win, and God, it became the Chip Beck layup and no guts and the whole thing. But until you're out there, you know, it's not so easy to pull off those kind of shots, you know, the second shots, the par fives with water all around. When look what J.B. Holmes, what happened to him yesterday. It can happen, and it's a razor's edge out there. So I don't know. I think with Poulter, I'll tell you what, last thing, I'm going on and on, but that was like the most courageous recovery shot after that drop I've ever seen.
Unbelievable.
So, I mean, how can you question this guy's courage?
Yeah.
I mean, it was awful. I know I would have been melting at that moment, you know, just by panicking and being embarrassed. And, oh, I just hit a shank. This is going to get worse. I'm going to make a 12. And he stiffs it. I mean, that's a real pro. So,
yeah, it's, you know, and it goes back. I mean, I've thought about this for a long time. I mean, it's a lot easier for an established player to win than it is for somebody that's not established. And of course, Ian Poulter, you know, established for decades, but I mean, not anymore. I mean, he's not that player
anymore. It slips away, man. It goes away fast and you lose everything.
Yeah, I mean, when Phil Mickelson is playing for a Masters title, he could finish second or 30th, and I don't really think it matters to him, truly. And I don't think the same thing for a Tiger. I mean, this generation, you've got Rory, Jason Day, Jordan Spieth. You know, if they finish 5th, 8th, or 10th, it doesn't matter. But for a lot of these players, that does matter. I mean, it matters for their careers, for their livelihood, and all that stuff. So I think, you know, of course, you know, the big names are going to be benefited by a lot of stuff. I mean, they're going to be benefited financially and sponsors and all that stuff. But they're also benefited because they have this security blanket, knowing that whatever happens doesn't really matter. This week doesn't matter. And for Ian Poulter, this week did matter. 2nd, 4th, 6th, all that stuff could come back in a big way, not just this year, but the next year and the year after. I mean, now you think Ryder Cup next year. I mean, there's a lot of things that come into play. And so,
a lot of things. And, you know, he's like a post-traumatic stress syndrome survivor. You know, I mean, he just lost his card. You know, so he's just fresh off of that scar, and he doesn't want to go back to that place.
Yeah.
So I have no problem with what he did. And, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, it wasn't like this complete, you know, button putters down the fairway. I mean, he just made some percentage plays.
Right.
That's about as scary a finish as there is in golf. I don't know. I mean, it may not have been the most entertaining for you know, it's like the gladiators, you know, Roman gladiator. You want to see the guy get killed, but it's come on, these guys got to survive and live to fight another day.
Exactly. And like you said, I thought you made a great point. I mean, this is a golf course that historically is a place you can lose it. I mean, we've seen it so many times. There's so many places you can hit the ball. I mean, they showed that Adam Scott replay of him hitting that second shot in the water on 18 when he won. I mean, I probably saw it 20 times throughout the week. I mean, anything can happen there. So I think it's a great point as well. I mean, we can sit here and say maybe he was playing for second, but he was also – maybe he was playing smart. I don't fault Poulter at all. I would have been doing the exact same thing.
If somebody had – if it wasn't Poulter, who I think's a little shaky ball striking-wise – on that golf course on that day, you know, if it was DJ or somebody, like you said, well, regardless of the thing about, you know, having this incredible career safety net, I get that too. But and that's a big factor. But if somebody was really like Joe Durant, if he came, and I know that's a name you just pull out of the hat, but that guy never misses a shot. And, you know, if he was suddenly laying up all over the place, I'd go, wow, that's different.
Right.
You know, but, you know, Ian Poulter is a guy who can hit a little crooked, so I think, and he's a great, you know, generally has been a good putter, and I just think he did what was right for him.
Well, I was going to bring this up a little later, but I wanted to dive into it now because I think you and I, if nothing else, it'll be an interesting conversation coming off what just happened. I mean, we see Siwoo Kim win the Players. I haven't seen what ratings look like, but I can only assume the ratings are going to be down considering, you know, we didn't have a ton of quote unquote star power atop the leaderboard. You mentioned Justin Rose earlier, and I'm going to talk about Justin Rose to make this point. I feel like we're getting to a place in professional golf, especially PGA Tour golf, where there's about four or five names that matter. When I say they matter, I mean it matters to the general sports fan and even the general golf fan. You know, Rory, you know, Dustin, Ricky, you know, Day, and Spieth, really, and McIlroy. I mean, these are the names that we talk about before every tournament. And we dissect every round they play, and if they do something bad, we jump on it. I mean, I look back at the Masters with Justin Rose, and he was shaky at the end, very shaky, and he hit a shaky tee shot in that playoff. If that's Jordan Spieth, aren't we really jumping all in on what happened with Rose at the end of the Masters? And when we look at an event like the Players' Championship, when those guys don't play well, it does seem like we almost focus as much on them as we do with the guys that had a good week, forgetting what golf really is.
Well, you know, I think it's a complicated time. One thing I think has happened is we have a Tiger hangover, so to speak. In other words, we apply the same standards we would apply to Tiger to all these guys. You know, supposedly they're all his successors and, you know, the princes who would be kings, and they're competing for that. But they're not Tiger. I mean, they're great in many ways, although I wouldn't say anybody but Rory is historically great yet. And I think sometimes we ascribe too much early greatness because they're so impressive, you know, in many ways, not just not the way they carry themselves, you know, in general, you know, they're really well-spoken. I mean, DJ is the exception, but DJ is sneaky smart, so he has his own allure. Anyway, I'm just saying we create stars, we create brands. You never used to hear that word. I mean, Arnold Palmer might have had a brand, I guess. He had the umbrella, but nobody else had a brand,
right,
really. And now it's all about, you know, ratings and public image and much more than just playing. So I think, you know, that has blinded us to the reality of professional golf, which is if you're out on the tour and you are out there an exempt player and you have a good week, you're going to be better than that than some star who has a bad week.
Right.
You know, and people don't want to accept that. They go, oh, how could you let Brian Gay beat you? Or, how, you know, throw a name out, you know. You know, but Brian Gay was playing good that week. Sorry. And DJ was hitting it all over the place. And Brian Gay, just like yesterday's, Siwoo Kim was the best player. And it just happens in golf. It's too hard of a game. There's too many variables to just kind of consistently be on top of and find a way every time. And the guy who came the closest after Jack was Tiger, and even more than Jack, in his concentrated period of time, no one has ever been as sustained at the top and sustained excellence like Tiger Woods. And it gave, I think, a false indicator of what golf really is. Nobody keeps it for very long. You know,
right,
there used to be that phrase, you know, we're all just renting.
Right.
You know, nobody owns it. And so, you know, asking Jordan or asking DJ or asking Rory or Jason Day, you know, to do it every time. first of all, I see them kind of cracking under the pressure a little, depending on their temperament. I mean, I see Jason Day kind of going, wow, this pressure of being number one, that was unbearable. I couldn't take it. I burned out. Well, part of it is because the expectation is we got to be like Tiger. And it's like, God, I can't do it. It's not golf. So, you know, I'm saying all these things and I'm going, that I'm not running these guys down by any means. But I think golf does itself a disservice by saying, well, you know, there were no stars at the top of the leaderboard. And so the ratings were down because, you know, it was boring. Well, if you like golf, you like good golf.
And right.
It doesn't matter who's hitting the ball. You're admiring where that ball is going and how that ball is being controlled and the score that's being shot. That's a purist. That's what I would say. You know, I mean, I call myself a purist, I guess. But, I mean, I try to remember every one of those guys has a story. And every one of those guys has come from on an incredible journey to get as good as they are. And we should never discount how good even the guy who's barely exempt out there is and how capable he is of doing something really special like this kid did yesterday. So it's not just the four that we're talking about that we should be expecting that from. We should occasionally expect it every week from somebody. It's just it's too much to expect one of those four to keep doing it all the time. Like this whole thing about, well, you know, DJ's the Masters obvious favorite. Well, he's never really played that great at Augusta.
Right.
Not saying he wouldn't, you know, I think he's finished fourth once. So, you know, is DJ like overwhelming just because he played good 3 weeks coming in? It doesn't always carry over. I mean, golf is week to week, day to day, shot to shot.
Right.
So, you know, I don't know. The best player still wins more often. He just doesn't win as often as we'd like it to happen.
Yeah.
And we're used to that in other sports because there's more domination in other sports. They're easier to dominate because I think there's just fewer variables.
Right. And you know, it's what I hate the term upset during the match play. It drives me crazy because I'm like,
right.
You know, like you mentioned, you know, Brian Gay, for instance. I mean, you know, if you look at a first round stroke play event every single week, Jordan Spieth probably is a first round leader three times a year, maybe, you know, maybe.
That's right.
And it's one of the best players in the world. I mean, he gets beat by these quote unquote no names all the time on a random round of golf. I mean, Spieth might win more over 4 days, but I mean, match play, 18 holes. Is it an upset? Is Søren Kjeldsen upsetting Rory an upset? I mean, to me, it's not really an upset. As you mentioned, this is one of the top 65 players. He's the top 65 at his profession in the entire world. I mean, he should be able to beat the guy that's 50 spots ahead of him. It just is what golf is. I find it interesting that, you know, with the idea of a Tiger hangover, you know, when we focus on these guys and more times than not, they disappoint because golf disappoints. I mean, golf is a sport that disappoints us all. I mean, we go out there, you know, every single time we tee it up, we have an idea in mind. This is going to be my career round. I'm going to pull this shot off. I'm going to make this putt. And a lot of the time we don't. So, you know, for a casual golf fan and casual golfers to watch these guys and question their ability, I mean, what's wrong with Rory McIlroy? You know, it almost is laughable at times because when you go, how's your golf game? Do you play well every single time? Nobody's going to say yes to that.
Well, Tiger gets spoiled us with that whole, you know, second place sucks.
That's right.
You know, I'm only here to win. And then he pulled it off enough times that it became the narrative. But, I mean, he can't live up to it. You know, it's too much. That was such an incredible moment in time, and it lasted a long time. But it was really the exception when you look back at the history of golf.
Well, it was interesting. I mean, it was a time where, you know, there was a couple of other superstars, really. I mean, you know, we had a cup of coffee with David Duval, and Ernie Els was there for a while. Vijay was there, Phil. But really, when you look past those, we were just, you know, fiending for another one. I mean, when Sergio came around in 99, I think we loved the idea. Oh, my goodness, we have another young guy that can play. This is unheard of. I mean, we were hoping so bad that they would clash for years and years and years. And, so, you know, Sergio's an example of this before the Masters was, you know, is his career disappointing? I would say it's not. I mean, he's won a lot. He's been a great player, and he seems to have a good life. It's just funny that, you know, there's certain guys that can take that last shot, and there's certain guys you don't want taking that shot. And one of those players could be a top 10 player in the world. I mean, just because he's consistently finished in the top five, you know, doesn't mean he's quote unquote clutch. So, you know, winning is a hard thing to do in every sport. And I think sometimes we overrate winning. I mean, I think that the Ian Poulter thing's a great example of this. You know, he finished second at the hardest, at the most competitive field in all of golf. I mean, that's something to be very, very proud of.
It is. Winning takes something special, though. And I think it's right to really be, you know, impressed and attracted and exalt that. And especially in golf, because everybody's losing all the time. And you know, the thing about golf, too, is in other sports, you know, you're playing against an opponent. And very often that opponent will give you, you know, he won't play that well. He played tennis, you know. In golf, you're playing against the golf course. And, you know, somebody's going to play really well that day. And it might not be you, even if you're leading. And the golf course beat you, not that other person necessarily. In other words, you weren't responding to his shots. Even in match play, you know, you're only, you're still having to hit that golf shot right on that golf course. You're matching up against the other player, but that other player's not doing anything to you other than psychologically, perhaps, if you're not in the right frame of mind to, you know, affect what you do with your golf ball. So there's just, it's a different thing relative to, you know, the other guy playing badly, which is often how other teams win in other team sports or even in other individual sports. In golf, if you play badly and you're around the leaderboard on Sunday, probably somebody among the other seven contenders is going to play well and beat you. You know, six of them might play bad, and then you know, and sometimes somebody will give it to you. But in general, you got to keep earning it in golf. There's just no easy path to a victory in golf. Rarely does it get given to somebody.
Right. I mean, if you look back over the last 2 years in majors, I just wanted to pull this up. I mean, you know, when you look at Jason Day at that PGA, he won it. I mean, he went out and won that. Danny Willett, for better or worse, won that. I mean, he shot 67 on Sunday. He needed a little bit of help, but, you know, he was flawless, you know, Sunday at the Masters. Dustin won it. Henrik won it. Jimmy Walker won it over Jason Day with Jason Day charging. And then Sergio, you know, Sergio had to pull off a lot of big-time golf shots. So a lot of the recent major winners were not handed anything. We saw with Siwoo Kim. I mean, was not handed anything, had to go out there and earn it himself. And, you know, a couple of guys struggled, but he didn't. And as you said, that is normally, especially now with the way the PGA Tour is and how talented it is, you know, this is where we're at. I mean, it's a talent-based fraternity of guys that have no fear for the most part. And, you know, you've got to go do something silly or somebody else is going to do it. I did want to touch on, you know, the new deal with the FedEx and the PGA Tour. You reported that on Golf Digest, had a great write-up about it. Something that I did find interesting on it was the idea that other branded, similar branded companies, you know, the players will not be allowed to play in the FedEx Cup. Can you expand a little bit more on the idea of that and how shocked you were when you initially heard that?
Well, you know, it's funny. When we were asking questions on Monday regarding that, I kind of misunderstood because part of the focus was on Louis Oosthuizen, you know, who represents UPS. What if Louis were to win the FedEx Cup? Would there be any problem with that? And it turns out that Louis, because he has a long, him specifically, and maybe another guy, I guess Lee Westwood, they're sort of grandfathered in. And so I took it to believe that there was no issue with a competing delivery company, you know. But now you have that sort of clause that you've got to either, if you have one of those competing sponsorship endorsement deals with one of those companies, you can't be in the FedEx Cup.
Right.
So I mean, that, you know, I thought that was kind of chilling. Yeah. I understand the reason for it, and I'm sure FedEx pushed hard for that, and that probably was a big sticking point. I'm sure the tour didn't want to give that up. I mean, you know, bigger realities take over, and you know, FedEx is doing a heck of a lot of stuff, so it's like, okay, that's a concession you get. But I know it doesn't sit well with the players. It kind of goes against the spirit of the whole independent contract, you know, kind of persona that they very much value. You know, I just hope it doesn't. I mean, there's endorsements out there, so, you know, I guess UPS is not going to be getting a lot of endorsements, you know, signing a lot of guys, or, you know, I don't know what the other companies, but
DHL or something. It just seemed petty. Yeah, I mean, it seemed a little petty to me.
I guess, but, you know, it's always been a little bit of a, it happens very seldom, but, you know, like when car companies would sponsor a tournament and then the winner would, like, you know, wear a Toyota hat or something. It would be a big deal to those sponsors. And it's like, hey, we're putting up $10 million. Now they put up $10 million. You know, if it's not going to be a win-win-win all the way down the board, it's not worth it. So, you know, for them and for the tour who's out there, you know, trying to line up these sponsors, you know, they can't have too many of these potential surprises arising. You know, maybe it sounds petty, but I think the way signage is and branding, I mean, those things are highly negotiated deals. And all these stadiums that we see in other sports all have a, you know, a corporation they're named after. So that's where the money's coming from. And there's a calculation. This matters in terms of people identifying with your product and your brand. And there could, you know, if UPS, if let's say Louis had one yesterday, I'm sure there would have been some comments about, you know, a lot of FedEx points for the UPS guy or something, that FedEx would not have liked.
Right, for sure.
So, you know, there you are.
Oh, yeah, and just, I just get a little nervous with this. Again, I mean, it seemed to kind of just be buried at the bottom of this big story about, you know, the FedEx Cup doing something great, which is putting money into a golf playoff system that probably means the PGA Championship is going to be moved, and now the end of season is just probably going to feel bigger because it's going to be, you know, a good month and a half, 2 months before, you know, basically since the last major, which I think will be nice. But, you know, my fear is, you know, AT&T gets wind of this, and now their next contract deal, you know, a Verizon guy can't play it, Byron Nelson. Now, you know, it's just, it seems like a slippery slope.
It is a slippery slope, and I'll be honest, you know, I missed, when I was talking, asking questions, we missed the story that day, but partly because I don't think anybody wanted, neither the tour nor FedEx wanted that to be publicized. That was dug out later by somebody who, you know, I don't know who broke the story, but, you know, somebody who sort of looked into the details and finally ended up asking the very direct question. We asked some questions, but when Louis became the example, it turns out he was grandfathered, so they didn't have to confront, you know, what about future guys? And nobody pursued the question. So it did get buried initially, and I think it is a, you know, that principle of, is it a slippery slope? I don't think it will be. Especially now that so much attention has been brought to this and it doesn't look that good necessarily. But I think with FedEx, they're just too big to fail in a way.
Right,
so,
right.
So they got, you know, they got their way on this one. But it, yeah, I'm sure, you know, there's some worry that it'll be a precedent setter. I don't think it will be because I think it will make, at that point, it will make golf look petty.
So I wanted to kind of close this out. Just wanted to ask a little bit about Phil Mickelson. You know, he's 46 years old. He turns 47. He's playing solid golf, I'd say. I think that's probably a nice way to encapsulate his year. Is it hasn't been great. It hasn't been bad. It's been solid. But we are seeing this theme of getting out of contention and it not really mattering much to him. Is Phil physically incapable still to win a golf tournament and play all 72 holes well enough to beat, you know, the Siwoo Kims and the Jason Days and such out there? I mean, do you see him finally getting a victory this year, considering he has been in the conversation a lot after a couple of rounds?
I would not count Phil out. You know, I've been, I don't say critical, but I would say Phil's, over the years, for a guy who won 42 tournaments and five majors, his bad golf's as bad as anybody's I've seen of that caliber, which aren't that many guys. I mean, he's probably a top 10 player all time, very close to it. And maybe, you know, in one more major, he gets in the, close to the top five. But what I would say about Phil is, you know, when he's not on, you know, it goes sideways, and, you know, his short game can only save him so much. I think since he's been working with this Andrew Getson, he's been very enthused because his swing's gotten more solid, and he's become a better ball striker. But the bottom line for me with Phil is it's just motivation. I mean, when he's... like, he had his back to the wall at the Ryder Cup this year. You know, I mean, everything was riding on the U.S. winning and the task force being justified, and Phil was identified with that task force, and he knew they lost, and he played bad. He was going to be, you know, annihilated
right
in the press. And he played, I mean, that was so clutch. He sucked it up, and, I mean, that match with Sergio at the end, I know the match was over by that time, but Phil played great, and he answered the bell. And so I guess what I'm saying is when his mind is right, I mean, the victory at the British Open in 2013, that came out of nowhere. I mean, he had not had a great British Open record. But when Phil gets in the hunt, he has a closer's mentality. He's a great competitor. I mean, he was overshadowed by Tiger because there's never been a competitor like Tiger. But Phil was close, and his closing record is really high. So I think if he gets there again, you know, he's very capable of doing it. The problem is he's just, I think, to your point, you know, it's not so much age as it is boredom.
Right. I totally agree.
It's just hard for him, you know, to really dig deep enough to, and I think that's one reason he plays those matches on during the week with those young guys. He's trying to keep himself refreshed and energized and motivated and having fun. And that's the battle for him, because really, you know, what's it going to matter if he wins another tour event? He's trying to point for these majors. But if you don't win tour events, you're not really ready to win major, probably. So he's got a little conundrum there. And I think he's trying to peak for the four, and it puts a lot of pressure. All I would say is Muirfield, although it's now been 4 years, you know, you could arguably say he's actually hitting the ball better these days than he was then. The putter doesn't look it can look really good sometimes, but, you know, he has these little walkabout moments where he starts missing a lot of four-footers, and, you know, he's not good enough, as anybody isn't actually, to miss many of those in a tournament.
I mean, I'm
always amazed at the inside the 10 feet stat at the end of 72 holes. I mean, these guys go 61 out of 62,
right.
You know. I mean, they just do not miss. And so, you know, that's a lot of pressure when you have a five-footer now. It's like, if I miss two of these, I'm not going to win this tournament.
Yeah, I'm done. It's been an interesting
You can't really think that way, but
that's right.
We
think like that. That's why we're not out there. Well, it's been an interesting year. I'll just say that. I can't get a feel for this 2017 season. I mean, you know, we've seen Rory injured, and he mentioned at the Players he's now got more back issues. And, you know, we had the Dustin situation at the Masters where he's rolling in as red hot as we've seen anybody in decades to Augusta National. And he has a fluke injury and he's out. And Jason Day's been kind of in and out. And, you know, Jordan Spieth's looked great at times and looked awful at times. And, I mean, I'm focusing back on these names. No, you're right, though.
They are the definers. I agree with you. I wasn't trying to discount that.
Right, it's just a weird year. It's just kind of been a weird season.
Well, very much so. I mean, I just heard Jason Day, you know, at the Players, and man, that was a candid interview and almost a little, you know, wince-inducing, because he clearly was uncomfortable with the whole, you know, number one thing. And, you know, unless a guy really enjoys that role, and it's going to be very hard to keep. And we've seen a lot of players over the years almost withdraw from it. I mean, I remember when Fred Couples got it, like he couldn't get rid of it fast enough.
Right.
And he was really good. And, you know, Davis Love didn't really want it. And, you know, some guys just weren't good enough to keep it. I think Adam Scott enjoyed it, but, you know, he just doesn't putt well enough to stay there. But, I mean, Norman, man, he jealously guarded that thing. He wanted it so bad. And same thing with Tiger. And, I mean, I think you have to have that attitude. I think the guy who, of the four, the guy who wants it would be the most comfortable with that role would be Jordan. And he probably has the least, and this is not a knock, but of those four, the least firepower to kind of sustain his way at the top. Because he just doesn't make that many really easy birdies like Dustin does, or Jason when he's rolling, or even Rory. I say even. Those three. They have power. Power is easier to sustain. Most of the number one players who had a long run have been power players. But I think Jordan has the mentality of the number one more than the other three do. And, you know, the wild card is sort of DJ, because, I mean, I think he is sneaky competitive, and I think he's really enjoying kind of having, you know, really, you know, regrouped and in a way, you know, really learned to appreciate his gift and now taking advantage of it. And he might be, you know, and it was just a shame he fell at the Masters. That was really a fluky thing. But he might be that he's really comfortable and really likes this. And if he does, you know, and, you know, it's been very impressive to watch him putt better and wedge the ball better and improve those weaknesses. And that's not an easy thing to do in your 30s. It may be that he's the guy who's best suited for a long run.
Is there something, there's got to be something, and I was going to ask you, I mean, doesn't it feel like, and this is not a knock on Dustin, but it feels like his mentality and basic mental approach to the game of golf could only benefit him with these types of things, because he doesn't make it bigger than it is. I mean, you get to number one in the world and it's this huge deal, and, you know, your sponsors are taking out full page ads in magazines and newspapers, and, well, maybe not newspapers, but, you know, maybe, you know, online, and it's this big flash thing and it's this huge deal and you're number one. And I feel like Dustin, Dustin might not even check that stuff. And second, you know, it's probably just a thing to him. And we heard him during that press conference of the Masters, you know, a lot of questions were sent his way about, you know, being number one in this moment, and you're playing so well, and it's like, he might as well be 80th on the money list. He doesn't really care either way, it seems like.
Well, I think he cares.
Yeah, just cares,
that I don't think he cares about the what would you call it? The you know,
the noise around it.
Yeah, the noise around it. I think he's really he's a jock. You know, he's a competitive kid who grew up, you know, being the best at every one of his sports, and he likes that. He likes to win. He likes being the best athlete out there, and I think he carries himself that way. And I think the other guys in the locker room, they look at him that way. It's like, you know, every team and every locker room kind of has a stud, and he's the stud of the PGA Tour. And I think he likes that, and I think he wants to keep that, you know, that sort of mantle. And and number one kind of goes along with it. And I think when he's playing, he cares a lot.
Right.
But once it's over, I think, and I've seen guys like this in other sports, and you probably have too, I'm sure, they have a great way of just, you know, disassociating from the result. And that's over, and I go to the next one. And I think it's a great attitude, a healthy attitude. Now, obviously, there was a time when it looked like DJ didn't care. And he was wasting, you know, he was wasting that incredible gift. And, you know, he was having fun, and he was doing a lot of things. And I think he realized, man, you know, how am I going to be remembered, and how am I going to feel about myself in 20 years? Did I waste it? And so now I feel like he's pretty dedicated. I mean, just look at his body. I mean, he's in shape. He works out like crazy. His golf swing is very repetitive. You know, I mean, his numbers on TrackMan are like off the charts great. I think he's worked hard to get where he is, and I think he wants to capitalize on it. So that, to me, shows he does care. Now, when it's over and he's lost and it's a tough loss, I'd say that's actually an asset to be able to forget. I mean, what happened at Chambers Bay? I mean, not many guys recover from that. And he did right away, bam. I mean, and Oakmont was really inspiring. So, I give him the benefit of the doubt. Now, is he a maniac like Tiger? Probably not.
Right.
I mean that.
Again, care was the wrong word. It's just, I feel like being great at golf and winning is a thing he enjoys because he puts the time in to do it. But I think if you told him he was number one or four in the world, you know, and you tried to break down the official world golf ranking points and what he's got to do, you know, I just feel like, you know, that's the type of stuff. He just feels like if he plays well, all that stuff kind of comes with it. So I just think that Dustin's mentality in golf and in this sport is probably the best mentality we've seen in years from a star level type of player, because he doesn't get in his own way, which I think is a thing almost every golfer does, even when they get to that point.
You know, it's a really, I'm sure I would agree like 99% of what you're saying. I just think the guys who are, okay, that is the healthiest attitude, what he's got for normally wired people. For the genius level guys, they feed off obsession. I think Tiger fed off obsession. I think even in his own way, Jack fed off obsession. Hogan definitely fed off obsession, and it made him better. You know, it can drive some guys crazy and make them worse. And we know those guys, all those haunted guys. We might be one of them. But, you know, as far as, you know, trying too hard and getting in your own way. But the genius knows how to stay out of his own way and still stay obsessed. And, you know, it's, I don't even know how to define it, but you kind of know it when you see it.
Right.
And you definitely saw it with Tiger. And I think Jack, when you talk to him, you realize, you know, it's always an honor to talk to him now because he's very open about now his career and his year. And Trevino, all those guys, man, they lived it every day. I don't think, you know, Jack was the more balanced one, supposedly, but when he played, it was all in. So, you know, I think that's the separator of greatness, is caring to the extent that that's all that matters. It may make your life a little nuts, and maybe, you know, you don't have all the balance that you'd like to have, but that one thing that you do, you're doing it better than anybody in the world. And, you know, maybe Dustin doesn't have that. I don't know. I sort of feel Jordan does. And that's why I kind of am drawn to Jordan, because I sort of feel like, you know, he's passionate. He's really passionate. And, you know, Rory talks about it. I don't sense it as much, and that maybe is unfair to him. But I also don't see it in his manner on the golf course. Jordan, I see this kid, and I know he gets red lines sometimes, and sometimes it's unattractive to watch him, you know, talk to the golf ball and stuff. But it's because he's completely immersed. And I think that greatness lies in that a lot of times.
Yeah, I think I've always said, I think if the 1988 Open Championship was on TV, I'm not sure Rory's stopping on the in DVR in it, and I think Jordan might. You know, it's that level of loving, you know, all of this that surrounds the game. And Rory has been open about it for years. I mean, he says, this is my job. And I mean, I think that's a very healthy approach as well. And, you know, lucky for Rory, he's got more talent in a couple of his fingers than, you know, probably about half the PGA Tour. So it helps out a lot when
you
like that.
We eat these guys up. I say we in the media, but everybody, you know, we in every endeavor in life. You know, you see somebody who's great and you want to push them to greatness more and more and more. And then, you know, that person starts living for that endeavor. And then you see so often, you know, the greatness comes and then the life's a mess. You know, I just read this long biography of Frank Sinatra. And he really did. He cared about his singing. I mean, that was the one place where he was really in control. But, you know, everything else was, you know, just a chaos. And part of it, and he fed off that chaos to make his singing great, because it was the one place that, okay, everything now, it doesn't matter except what I do right now. And I think it's a refuge. And, you know, Kurt Sampson wrote that great book about Hogan. And, you know, Hogan was probably kind of OCD. You know, he just hit balls and balls and balls because that was the one place in life that he was happy. So it's so complicated. But all these great guys, the all-time great guys, they're a lot. They're different. They're different and they're fascinating. And then, you know, we want that from all of them. At the same time, you're right. You have a mature view and go, well, wait a minute. They got a life too. And so how can you condemn whoever it is, Rory or anybody, you know, for saying, you know, I just want some balance and I want to be happy. And they have that right. But it's just that we want them to be just great at golf.
We're like, but you haven't won a major since 2014. Right, it's like, right. We're screaming into a soundproof room at him or whatever. But it's funny. It's been an interesting year. I'm obviously eagerly awaiting Aaron Hills. What do you have planned? Not just for Golf World and Golf Digest, but stuff coming out over the next few weeks.
Well, I just did something on John Rahm that's going to run for the Open preview. It's like, you know, this guy could win the Open, but a lot of things, now with the web, you just kind of react, you know, and we'll have an Open preview. That's the next thing that we're working on, but I don't know a lot about Aaron Hills. I played it. It's a big ballpark, as they say. I think you'll see a lot of drivers there, which I kind of like. I like that in the U.S. Open. To me, it's the greatest test of who's really, you know, sort of the most athletic, cool player to watch. Can you hit a driver in the fairway at a U.S. Open fairway?
Right. I
like that about Oakmont. I love the way DJ drove it. That was so impressive. And Cabrera did that when he won in 2007. Those are the most exciting Opens to me, when a guy, you know, with that much length has to thread something in a 40-yard fairway or a 30-yard fairway. So I think we'll see some of that at Aaron Hills. I don't know if it, you know, no one's ever called it one of the greatest courses of all time, but sometimes, something that I think pushes them to hit a lot of drivers just creates a I don't know. I'm stumbling here, but I love Marion. I love, you know, Shinnecock, but the ball's going so far now, you just need to give them some space to air it out. Otherwise, the game starts looking, to me, almost like little ball too much, you know?
I totally agree. I mean, this is a place, I played it all the way back in September, and it was like 8,100 yards from the back, and I hit kind of a little...
Was over 8,000 yards.
Oh, yeah, I hit like a thin drive on the first hole's a par 5 at Aaron Hills, and I didn't get it all. It was early in the morning, and my caddy's just screaming at it to go, and I'm like, go.
Just got to get it to
the fairway. But we're all headed out. The Fox team's going out this coming weekend, so we're all going to get a chance to go out there and kind of, feel it out. And, you know, you said it. I mean, these golf courses that are a little unknown, but they're long ballparks. I mean, you know, say what you want about Chambers Bay, but I mean, that's
produced
been
a hell of a
one of the more dramatic finishes. I mean, with Rory and Adam Scott and Oosthuizen making these runs, and then of course it ended up being Dustin and Jordan Spieth. We would definitely take those names again.
I love the last hole at Aaron Hills. I remember it seemed like about 700 yards. So, but I love when these tournaments end on a par 5. It just the one at Wachovia
right
at Eagle Point. That was a great finishing hole. A lot happens on a par 5. So I and not many U.S. Open have a closing par 5. So and Chambers Bay did at least half the days. And this one will be all 4.
Yeah,
so
it's 4 par 5s. I mean, first time since 92 we've had a 4 par 5 U.S. Open. So that's like 30 days away, which is crazy to think. Jaime, I appreciate you taking some time and jumping on. It was a great conversation. We'll definitely do it again maybe sometime around the Open Championship.
Anytime, Shane. Thank you very much.
It looks like I'm a wreck. It's in the hole! It's in the hole!
Many thanks to Ogio for sponsoring this Post Players Clubhouse podcast. Ogio makes insane golf bags that any golfer would love, and they also make the best backpacks on the market, period. From the Renegade for the constant traveler to the Axel and even the Tribune backpack for kids that need something for school, Ogio's line has something for you. Get yourself an Ogio bag that makes work, travel, and much more easier and safer. All of those plus their entire line of golf bags are available at ogio.com, O-G-I-O.com. Go give it a look. Many thanks to Jaime Diaz. Really enjoyed the conversation. He, as I said, he's one of the best minds in the game. He covers it really from every single angle, week in and week out, and has been doing it for many, many decades. So many thanks to him. We'll definitely have him back on the Clubhouse podcast. Working on another one for later this week. It's going to be busy. The next few weeks get really, really busy. We go to Erin Hills. The Fox team goes there over the weekend. Also going to check out Sand Valley, so I'm pretty fired up for that. Of course, that's the new property that's making Wisconsin this big golf mecca. As long as you don't go in the winter, which I hear is a little tougher to play. But excited to see Sand Valley get another crack at Erin Hills, so I'll let you know how that goes. I'm going to have a little side bet with Paul Azinger. Azinger was trash-talking me at the Masters. He was trash-talking me hard. He was making a big scene, too, saying he was going to take me down. So I might take on a major champion, so I'm probably going to have to visit the ATM once or twice while in Wisconsin. But I'll bring you that. I might bring Zinger on, depending on how the match goes next week, just so he can really, we can hash it out. Mono e mono. But check back with the Clubhouse later this week. We might have a player on. If not, we'll be back. We will be back next week. If you love the podcast, subscribe, comment, do all that stuff. Let your friends know about it. I have some koozies here that I'm sending out to some nice people that sent me tweets after last week's episode with Brooks Koepka, so you'll be getting those. We have many more giveaways to get near as we near and near and near Erin Hills. I'll buy a couple things from Erin Hills next week, and if you've listened this long, maybe sneak me an email and let me know you would be one of those people that like something from Erin Hills. Maybe you'll get it. We will be back. Hope you get some time to go out and hit some balls. The weather is getting unbelievable, just basically everywhere in the country. So dust the grips off. It's time for golf season.